Albert picked up the book of matches he had taken from the bowl in the restaurant. Exhibit A, he said. Here goes. He tore a match from the book and struck it. His unsteady hands betrayed him, and he struck the match a full 2 inches above the rough strip which ran along the bottom of the paper folder. The match bent. Shit, Albert cried. Would you like me to... Bob again. Let him alone, Brian said. It's Albert's show. Steady on, Albert, Nick said. Albert tore another match from the book, offered them a sickly smile, and struck it. The match didn't light. He struck it again. The match didn't light. I guess that does it, Brian said. There's nothing... I smelled it, Nick said. I smelled the sulfur. Try another one, Ace. Instead, Albert snapped the same match across the rough strip a third time. And this time it flared a light. It did not just burn the flammable head and then gutter out. It stood up in the familiar little teardrop shape, blue at its base, yellow at its tip, and began to burn the paper stick. Albert looked up, a wild grin on his face. You see, he said. You see? He shook the match out, dropped it, and pulled another. This one lit on the first strike. He bent back the cover of the matchbook and touched the lit flame to the other matches, just as Bob Jenkins had done in the restaurant. This time they all flared alight with a dry fss sound. Albert blew them out like a birthday candle. It took 2 puffs of air to do the job. You see, he asked. You see what it means? Two-way traffic. We brought our own time with us. There's the past out there, and everywhere, I guess, east of the hole we came through. But the present is still in here. Still caught inside this airplane.
I don't know, Brian said.
But suddenly, everything seemed possible again. He felt a wild, almost unrestrainable urge to pull Albert into his arms and pound him on the back.
Bravo, Albert, Bob said. The beer. Try the beer.
Albert spun the cap off the beer while Nick fished an unbroken glass from the wreckage around the drinks trolley. Where's the smoke? Brian asked.
Smoke? Bob asked, puzzled. Well, I guess it's not smoke exactly, but when you open a beer, there's usually something that looks like smoke around the mouth of the bottle.
Albert sniffed, then tipped the beer toward Brian. Smell. Brian did, and began to grin. He couldn't help it. By God, it sure smells like beer, smoke or no smoke. Nick held out the glass, and Albert was pleased to see the Englishman's hand was not quite steady either.
Pour it, he said. Hurry up, mate. My sore bones say suspense is bad for the old ticker.
Albert poured the beer, and their smiles faded. The beer was flat, utterly flat. It simply sat in the whiskey glass Nick had found, looking like a urine sample.
Christ almighty, it's getting dark.
The people standing at the windows looked around as Rudy Warwick joined them.
You're supposed to be watching the nut, Don said.
Rudy gestured impatiently.
He's out like a light. I think that whack on the head rattled his furniture a little more than we thought at first. What's going on out there? And why is it getting dark so fast?
We don't know, Bethany said. It just is. Do you think that weird dude is going into a coma or something like that?
I don't know, Rudy said. But if he is, we won't have to worry about him anymore, will we? Christ, does that sound creepy? Sounds like a bunch of coked-up termites in a balsa wood glider.
For the first time, Rudy seemed to have forgotten his stomach. Dinah looked up at Laurel.
I think we better check on Mr. Toomey, she said. I'm worried about him. I bet he's scared.
If he's unconscious, Dinah, there isn't anything we can...
I don't think he's unconscious, Dinah said quietly. I don't think he's even asleep.
Laurel looked down at the child thoughtfully for a moment and then took her hand. All right, she said. Let's have a look. The knot Nick Hopewell had tied against Craig's right wrist finally loosened enough for him to pull his hand free. He used it to push down the loop holding his left hand. He got quickly to his feet. A bolt of pain shot through his head, and for a moment he swayed. Flocks of black dots chased across his field of vision and then slowly cleared away. He became aware that the terminal was being swallowed in gloom. Premature night was falling. He could hear the chew, crunch, chew sound of the langoliers much more clearly now, perhaps because his ears had become attuned to them, perhaps because they were closer. On the far side of the terminal, he saw two silhouettes, one tall and one short, break away from the others and start back toward the restaurant. The woman with the bitchy voice and the little blind girl with the ugly, pouty face. He couldn't let them raise the alarm. That would be very bad. Craig backed away from the bloody patch of carpet where he had been lying, never taking his eyes from the approaching figures. He could not get over how rapidly the light was failing. There were pots of eating utensils set into a counter to the left of the cash register, but it was all plastic crap. No good to him. Craig ducked around the cash register and saw something better, a butcher knife lying on the counter next to the grill. He took it and crouched behind the cash register to watch them approach. He watched the little girl with a particular anxious interest. The little girl knew a lot, too much maybe. The question was, where had she come by her knowledge? That was a very interesting question indeed, wasn't it? Nick looked from Albert to Bob.
So, he said, the matches work, but the lager doesn't.
He turned to set the glass of beer on the counter.
What does that mean?
All at once, a small mushroom cloud of bubbles burst from nowhere in the bottom of the glass. They rose rapidly, spread, and burst into a thin head at the top. Nick's eyes widened. Apparently, Bob said dryly, it takes a moment or two for things to catch up. He took the glass, drank it off, and smacked his lips.
Excellent, he said.
They all looked at the complicated lace of white foam on the inside of the glass.
I can say without doubt that it's the best glass of beer I ever drank in my life.
Albert poured more beer into the glass. This time it came out foaming. The head overspilled the rim and ran down the outside. Brian picked it up.
Are you sure you want to do that, matey? Nick asked, grinning. Don't you fellows like to say 24 hours from bottle to throttle?
In cases of time travel, the rule is suspended, Brian said. You could look it up. He tilted the glass, drank, then laughed out loud.
You're right, he said to Bob. It's the best goddamn beer there ever was. Try the Pepsi, Albert.
Albert opened the can, and they all heard the familiar pop hiss of carbonation, mainstay of 100 soft drink commercials. He took a deep drink. When he lowered the can, he was grinning, but there were tears in his eyes.
Gentlemen, the Pepsi Cola is also very good today, he said in plummy head waiter's tones, and they all began to laugh.
Don Gaffney caught up with Laurel and Dinah just as they entered the restaurant.
I thought I'd better,
he began and then stopped. He looked around.
Oh, shit. Where is he?
I don't, Laurel began, and then from beside her, Dinah Bellman said,
Be quiet.
Her head turned slowly, like the lamp of a dead searchlight. For a moment, there was no sound at all in the restaurant. At least, no sound Laurel could hear.
There,
Dinah said at last and pointed toward the cash register.
He's hiding over there, behind something.
How do you know that?
Donna asked in a dry, nervous voice.
I don't hear.
I do, Dinah said calmly. I hear his fingernails on metal, and I hear his heart. It's beating very fast and very hard. He's scared to death. I feel so sorry for him.
She suddenly disengaged her hand from Laurel's and stepped forward.
Dinah, no! Laurel screamed.
Dinah took no notice. She walked toward the cash register. Arms out, fingers seeking possible obstacles. The shadows seemed to reach for her and enfold her.
Mr. Toomey, please come out. We don't want to hurt you. Please don't be afraid.
A sound began to arise from behind the cash register. It was a high, keening scream. It was a word, or something which was trying to be a word, but there was no sanity in it. Craig arose from his hiding place, eyes blazing, butcher knife upraised, suddenly understanding that it was her. She was one of them. Behind those dark glasses, she was one of them. She was not only a Langolier, but the head Langolier. The one who was calling the others, calling them with her dead, blind eyes. You! He rushed at her, shrieking. Don Gaffney shoved Laurel out of the way, almost knocking her to the floor, and leaped forward. He was fast, but not fast enough. Craig Toomey was crazy, and he moved with the speed of a Langolier himself. He approached Dinah at a dead-out run. No scampering for him. Dinah made no effort to draw away. She looked up from her darkness and into his, and now she held her arms out as if to enfold him and comfort him.
It's all right, Mr. Toomey, she said. Don't be afraid.
And then Craig buried the butcher knife in her chest and ran past Laurel into the terminal, still shrieking. Dinah stood where she was for a moment. Her hands found the wooden handle jutting out of the front of her dress, and her fingers fluttered over it, exploring it. Then she sank slowly, gracefully, to the floor, becoming just another shadow in the growing darkness. Albert, Brian, Bob, and Nick passed the peanut butter and jelly sandwich around. They each got two bites, and then it was gone. But while it lasted, Albert thought he had never sunk his teeth into such wonderful chow in his life. His belly awakened and immediately began clamoring for more.
I think our bold friend, Mr. Warwick, is going to like this part best, Nick said, swallowing.
He looked at Albert.
You're a genius, Ace. You know that, don't you? Nothing but a pure genius.
Albert flushed happily. It wasn't much, he said. Just a little of what Mr. Jenkins calls the deductive method. If two streams flowing in different directions come together, they mix and make a whirlpool. I saw what was happening with Bethany's matches and thought something like that might be happening here. And there was Mr. Gaffney's bright red shirt. It started to lose its color, so I thought, well, if stuff starts to fade when it's not on the plane anymore, maybe if you brought faded stuff onto the plane, it would... I hate to interrupt, Bob said softly,
but I think that if we intend to try and get back, we should start the process as soon as possible. The sounds we are hearing worry me, but there's something else that worries me more. This airplane is not a closed system. I think there's a good chance that before long it will begin to lose its
temporal integrity, Albert suggested.
Yes, well put. Any fuel we load into its tanks now may burn, but a few hours from now it may not.
An unpleasant idea occurred to Brian, that the fuel might stop burning halfway across the country with the 767 at 36,000 feet. He opened his mouth to tell them this, and then closed it again. What good would it do to put the idea in their minds when they could do nothing about it?
How do we stop, Brian?
Nick asked in clipped, businesslike tones. Brian ran the process over in his mind. It would be a little awkward, especially working with men whose only experience with aircraft probably began and ended with model planes, but he thought it could be done.
We start by turning on the engines and taxing as close to that Delta 727 as we can get, he said. When we get there, I'll kill the starboard engine and leave the port side engine turning over. We're lucky. This 767 is equipped with wet-wing fuel tanks and an APU system that...
A shrill, panicked scream drifted up to them, cutting across the low, rattling background noise like a fork drawn across a slate blackboard. It was followed by running footfalls on the ladder. Nick turned in that direction, and his hands came up in a gesture Albert recognized at once. He had seen some of the martial arts freaks at school back home practicing the move. It was the classic Taekwondo defensive position. A moment later, Bethany's pallid, terrified face appeared in the doorway, and Nick let his hands relax.
Come! Bethany screamed. You've got to come!
She was panting, out of breath, and she reeled backward on the platform of the ladder. For a moment, Albert and Brian were sure she was going to tumble back down the steep steps, breaking her neck on the way. Then Nick leaped forward, cupped a hand on the nape of her neck, and pulled her into the plane. Bethany did not even seem to realize she had had a close call. Her dark eyes blazed at them from the white circle of her face.
Please come! He stabbed her! I think she's dying!
Nick put his hands on her shoulders and lowered his face toward her as if he intended to kiss her. Who stabbed whom? He asked very quietly. Who is dying?
Mr. Toomey.
Bethany, say teacup.
She looked at him, eyes shocked and uncomprehending. Brian was looking at Nick as though he had gone insane. Nick gave the girl's shoulders a little shake.
Say teacup right now.
Teacup.
Teacup and saucer. Say it, Bethany.
Teacup and saucer.
All right. Better? She nodded.
Yes.
Good. If you feel yourself losing control again, say teacup at once and you'll come back. Now, who's been stabbed?
The blind girl. Dinah.
Bloody shit.
All right, Bethany, just... Nick raised his voice sharply as he saw Brian move behind Bethany, headed for the ladder with Albert right behind him.
Now!
He shouted in a bright, hard tone that stopped both of them. Stay fucking put! Brian, who had served two tours in Vietnam and knew the sound of unquestionable command when he heard it, stopped so suddenly that Albert ran face-first into the middle of his back. I knew it, he thought. I knew he'd take over. It was just a matter of time and circumstance.
Do you know how this happened or where our wretched traveling companion is now? Nick asked Bethany.
The guy in the red shirt said...
All right, never mind. He glanced briefly up at Brian. His eyes were red with anger.
The bloody fools left him alone. I'd wager my pension on it. Well, it won't happen again. Our Mr. Toomey has caught his last caper.
He looked back at the girl. Her head drooped. Her hair hung dejectedly in her face. She was breathing in great, watery swoops of breath.
Is she alive, Bethany?
He asked gently.
I...
Teacup, Bethany.
Teacup!
Bethany shouted and looked up at him from teary, red-rimmed eyes.
I don't know. She was alive when I, came for you. She might be dead now. He really got her. Jesus, why did we have to get stuck with a fucking psycho? Weren't things bad enough without that?
And none of you who were supposed to be minding this fellow have the slightest idea where he went following the attack, is that right?
Bethany put her hands over her face and began to sob. It was all the answer any of them needed. Don't be so hard on her, Albert said quietly and slipped an arm around Bethany's waist. She put her head on his shoulder and began to sob more strenuously. Nick moved the two of them gently aside. If I was inclined to be hard on someone, it would be myself, Ace. I should have stayed behind. He turned to Brian.
I'm going back into the terminal. You're not. Mr. Jenkins here is almost certainly right. Our time here is short. I don't like to think just how short. Start the engines, but don't move the aircraft yet. If the girl is alive, we'll need the stairs to bring her up. Bob, bottom of the stairs. Keep an eye out for that bugger Toomey. Albert, you come with me.
Then he said something which chilled them all.
I almost hope she's dead, God help me. It will save time if she is.
Dinah was not dead, not even unconscious. Laurel had taken off her sunglasses to wipe away the sweat which had sprung up on the girl's face. And Dinah's eyes, deep brown and very wide, looked up unseeingly into Laurel's blue-green ones. Behind her, Don and Rudy stood shoulder to shoulder, looking down anxiously.
I'm sorry, Rudy said for the fifth time. I really thought he was out. Out cold.
Laurel ignored him. How are you, Dinah? She asked softly. She didn't want to look at the wooden handle growing out of the girl's dress, but couldn't take her eyes from it. There was very little blood, at least so far. A circle the size of a demitasse cup around the place where the blade had gone in, and that was all, so far.
It hurts, Dinah said in a faint voice. It's hard to breathe, and it's hot.
You're going to be all right, Laurel said, but her eyes were drawn relentlessly back to the handle of the knife. The girl was very small, and she couldn't understand why the blade hadn't gone all the way through her, couldn't understand why she wasn't dead already.
Out of here, Dinah said.
She grimaced, and a thick, slow curdle of blood escaped from the corner of her mouth and ran down her cheek. Don't try to talk, honey, Laurel said, and brushed damp curls back from Dinah's forehead.
You have to get out of here, Dinah insisted.
Her voice was little more than a whisper.
And you shouldn't blame Mr. Toomey. He's scared, that's all, of them.
Don looked around balefully.
If I find that bastard, I'll scare him, he said,
and curled both hands into fists. A lodge ring gleamed above one knuckle in the growing gloom.
I'll make him wish he was born dead.
Nick came into the restaurant then, followed by Albert. He pushed past Rudy Warwick without a word of apology and knelt next to Dinah. His bright gaze fixed upon the handle of the knife for a moment, then moved to the child's face. Hello, love, he spoke cheerily, but his eyes had darkened. I see you've been air-conditioned. Not to worry. You'll be right as a trivet in no time flat. Dinah smiled a little.
What's a trivet? She whispered.
More blood ran out of her mouth as she spoke, and Laurel could see it on her teeth. Laurel's stomach did a slow, lazy roll.
I don't know, but I'm sure it's something nice, Nick replied.
I'm going to turn your head to one side. Be as still as you can.
Okay.
Nick moved her head very gently until her cheek was almost resting on the carpet. Hurt?
Yes,
Dinah whispered.
Hot. hurts to breathe.
Her whispery voice had taken on a hoarse, cracked quality. A thin stream of blood ran from her mouth and pooled on the carpet less than 10 feet from the place where Craig Toomey's blood was drying. From outside came the sudden, high-pressure whine of aircraft engines starting. Don, Brody, and Albert looked in that direction. Nick never looked away from the girl. He spoke gently. Do you feel like coughing, Dinah?
Yes. No. Don't know.
It's better if you don't, he said. If you get that tickly feeling, try to ignore it. And don't talk anymore, right?
Don't hurt Mr. Toomey.
Her words, whispered though they were, conveyed great emphasis, great urgency. No, love, wouldn't think of it. Take it from me.
Don't trust you.
He bent, kissed her cheek, and whispered in her ear. But you can, you know. Trust me, I mean. For now, all you got to do is lie still and let us take care of things. He looked at Laurel. You didn't try to remove the knife.
I? No.
Laurel swallowed. There was a hot, harsh lump in her throat. The swallow didn't move it.
Should I have?
If you had, there wouldn't be much chance. Do you have any nursing experience?
No.
All right. I'm going to tell you what to do. But first, I need to know if the sight of blood, quite a bit of it, is going to make you pass out. And I need the truth.
Laurel said,
I haven't really seen a lot of blood since my sister ran into a door and knocked out two of her teeth while we were playing hide-and-seek, but I didn't faint then.
Good. And you're not going to faint now. Mr. Warwick, bring me half a dozen tablecloths from that grotty little pub around the corner.
He smiled down at the girl. Give me a minute or two, Dinah, and I think you'll feel much better. Young Dr. Hopewell is ever so gentle with the ladies, especially the ones who are young and pretty.
Laurel felt a sudden and absolutely absurd desire to reach out and touch Nick's hair.
What's the matter with you? This little girl is probably dying, and you're wondering what his hair feels like. Quit it. How stupid can you be?
Well, let's see. Stupid enough to have been flying across the country to meet a man I first contacted through the personals column of a so-called friendship magazine. Stupid enough to have been planning to sleep with him if he turned out to be reasonably presentable. And if he didn't have bad breath, of course. Oh, quit it. Quit it, Laurel.
Yes, the other voice in her mind agreed. You're absolutely right. It's crazy to be thinking things like that at a time like this, and I will quit it. But I wonder what young Dr. Hopewell would be like in bed. I wonder if he would be gentle, or...
Laurel shivered and wondered if this was the way your average nervous breakdown started.
They're closer, Dinah said. You really...
She coughed, and a large bubble of blood appeared between her lips. It popped, splattering her cheeks. Don Gaffney muttered and turned away.
Really have to hurry,
she finished. Nick's cheery smile didn't change a bit. I know, he said.
Craig dashed across the terminal, nimbly vaulted the escalator's handrail, and ran down the frozen metal steps with panic roaring and beating in his head like the sound of an ocean in a storm. It even drowned out that other sound, the relentless chewing, crunching sound of the langoliers. No one saw him go. He sprinted across the lower lobby toward the exit doors and crashed into them. He had forgotten everything, including the fact that the electric eye door openers wouldn't work with the power out. He rebounded, the breath knocked out of him, and fell to the floor, gasping like a netted fish. He lay there for a moment, groping for whatever remained of his mind, and found himself gazing at his right hand. It was only a white blob in the growing darkness, but he could see the black splatters on it, and he knew what they were. The little girl's blood. Except she wasn't a little girl, not really. She just looked like a little girl. She was the head langolier. And with her gone, the others won't be able to
what? To find him? But he could still hear the hungry sound of their approach. That maddening, chewing sound. As if somewhere to the east a tribe of huge, hungry insects was on the march. His mind whirled. Oh, he was so confused. Craig saw a small door leading outside, got up and started in that direction. Then he stopped. There was a road out there, and the road undoubtedly led to the town of Bangor, but so what? He didn't care about Bangor. Bangor was most definitely not part of that fabled big picture. It was Boston that he had to get to.
If he could get there, everything would be all right. And what did that mean? His father would have known. It meant he had to
stop scampering around and get with the program.
His mind seized on this idea the way a shipwreck victim seizes upon a piece of wreckage. Anything that still floats, even if it's only the shithouse door, is a prize to be cherished. If he could get to Boston, the whole experience would be set aside, he muttered. At the words, a bright beam of rational light seemed to shaft through the darkness inside his head, and a voice, it might have been his father's, cried out,
"Yes,"
in affirmation. But how was he to do that? Boston was too far to walk, and the others wouldn't let him back on board the only plane that still worked. Not after what he had done to their little blind mascot. "But they don't know," Craig whispered. "They don't know I did them a favor, because they don't know what she is." He nodded his head sagely. His eyes, huge and wet in the dark, gleamed. "Stow away," his father's voice whispered to him. "Stow away on the plane."
"Yes," his mother's voice added. "Stow away. That's the ticket, Craigie-waggy. Only if you do that, you won't need a ticket, will you?"
Craig looked doubtfully toward the luggage conveyor belt. He could use it to get to the tarmac, but suppose they had posted a guard by the plane. The pilot wouldn't think of it. Once out of his cockpit, the man was obviously an imbecile, but the Englishman almost surely would. So what was he supposed to do? If the Bangor side of the terminal was no good, and the runway side of the terminal was also no good, what was he supposed to do, and where was he supposed to go? Craig looked nervously at the dead escalator. They would be hunting him soon, the Englishman undoubtedly leading the pack. And here he stood in the middle of the floor, as exposed as a stripper who has just tossed her pasties and G-string into the audience. "I have to hide, at least for a while." He had heard the jet engine start up outside, but this did not worry him. He knew a little about planes and understood that Engel couldn't go anywhere until he had refueled, and refueling would take time. He didn't have to worry about them leaving without him. Not yet, anyway.
"Hide, Craigie-waggy. That's what you have to do right now. You have to hide before they come for you."
He turned slowly, looking for the best place, squinting into the growing dark. And this time he saw a sign on a door tucked between the Avis desk and the Bangor Travel Agency. "Airport Services," it read. A sign which could mean almost anything. Craig hurried across to the door, casting nervous looks back over his shoulder as he went and tried it. As with the door to airport security, the knob would not turn, but the door opened when he pushed on it. Craig took one final look over his shoulder, saw no one, and closed the door behind him. Utter, total dark swallowed him. In here, he was as blind as the little girl he had stabbed. Craig didn't mind. He was not afraid of the dark. In fact, he rather liked it. Unless you were with a woman. No one expected you to do anything significant in the dark. In the dark, performance ceased to be a factor. Even better, the chewing sound of the langoliers was muffled. Craig felt his way slowly forward, hands outstretched, feet shuffling. After three of these shuffling steps, his thigh came in contact with a hard object that felt like the edge of a desk. He reached forward and down. Yes, a desk. He let his hands flutter over it for a moment, taking comfort in the familiar accoutrements of white-collar America. A stack of paper, an in-out basket, the edge of a blotter, a caddy filled with paper clips, a pen and pencil set. He worked his way around the desk to the far side, where his hip bumped the arm of a chair. Craig maneuvered himself between the chair and the desk and then sat down. Being behind a desk made him feel better still. It made him feel like himself, calm, in control. He fumbled for the top drawer and pulled it open, felt inside for a weapon, something sharp. His hand happened almost immediately upon a letter opener. He took it out, shut the drawer, and put it on the desk by his right hand. He just sat there for a moment, listening to the muffled whisk thud of his heartbeat and the dim sound of the jet engines, then sent his hands fluttering delicately over the surface of the desk again until they re-encountered the stack of papers. He took the top sheet and brought it toward him, but there wasn't a glimmer of white, not even when he held it right in front of his eyes.
That's all right, Craggy-waggy. You just sit here in the dark. Sit here and wait until it's time to move. When the time comes...
I'll tell you, his father finished grimly. That's right, Craig said. His fingers spidered up the unseen sheet of paper to the right-hand corner. He tore smoothly downward. Rip! Calm filled his mind like cool blue water. He dropped the unseen strip on the unseen desk and returned his fingers to the top of the sheet. Everything was going to be fine, just fine. He began to sing under his breath in a tuneless little whisper. Just call me Angel of the Morning, baby. Rip! Just touch my cheek before you leave me, baby. Calm now, at peace. Craig sat and waited for his father to tell him what he should do next, just as he had done so many times as a child.